Well, friends, this week we have a new government and a new premier, a new leader, in fact. And as with any new leader, we speculate, don't we? What sort of leader will he be? And people have hopes and expectations for leaders, don't they? Including for this new leader. Some hope the new premier will indeed tear up the East-West link contract. Some hope he'll increase economic prosperity. Some hope that he'll make our state a fairer and more harmonious place. So the question is, what sort of leader will the new premier be? And I suppose only time will tell. And friends, in ancient Israel, there was speculation about a leader as well. And this speculation centered not around a state premier, but around the concept of Son of God. You see, originally, national Israel was collectively supposed to be God's son. We see that in Exodus 4. But Israel, of course, failed in that role. So throughout the Old Testament, the concept of Son of God became narrowed from Israel collectively to Israel's king specifically. And we see that in 2 Samuel 7. You see, Israel's king was supposed to be God's son. But as you'll remember, Israel's kings overall were unfaithful and they failed to be true and worthy sons of God. So again, friends, the Old Testament concept narrowed again so that the godly remnant within Israel were considered God's true sons. And friends, before Jesus' birth, some people started looking for a particular righteous individual who'd arrive as God's particular son. Some even expected a son who would suffer, whose suffering would somehow benefit others. And the scriptures behind these expectations included Psalms 22, which was read for us, and Psalm 69, and also Isaiah 42 and 49 and 50 and 53. But friends, also prior to Jesus' birth, many people were looking forward to the Messiah or Christ to come, God's ultimate righteous king who'd behave as God's true son. And of course, we've known ever since Mark chapter 1 verse 1 that this son is Jesus. In chapter 1 verse 1, we're told that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. And friends, in today's passage, we really see who Jesus is as God's true son and what it means for Jesus to be God's son. Friends, today we'll see that Jesus is the true Son of God who's willingly murdered by humanity to claim many sons and daughters for God from all humanity. Well, friends, last week we considered the terrible miscarriages of justice at Jesus' trials. Jesus was guilty of no crime, no evil, and Pilate, who had power of life and death over Jesus, knew that. Yet Pilate ignored the truth and sentenced Jesus to die by crucifixion. And we saw that in preparation for that, Jesus was scourged, which was a horrendous torture in which soldiers whipped a person to within an inch of their lives. Well, in chapter 15, verse 16, Jesus is still in the soldiers' custody. They've scourged him, probably in full public view, and now their job's to crucify him. That's what they're supposed to do. As civil servants, they're supposed to do what Pilate says. But instead, they've got their own sinister plans, and they lead Jesus not out to be crucified, but back into the palace. And they call together a whole battalion, which is 600 men. It's not because they need backup. They've just flogged Jesus, so he's no threat. No, they decide to put on a show, and it's a despicable show at that. These soldiers indulge in nasty and brutal mockery of Jesus. He's been sentenced to death for being King of the Jews. And the soldiers now mock him and belittle him as King of the Jews. They stick a purple robe on him, dyed with the most expensive dye, which represents royalty. And they stick a crown on his head, but it's not a crown made of leaves of gold, but from bare, hard thorns. And they pay false homage, saluting him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." And this is just a mocking takeoff of the salute which was normally given to Caesar. And the soldiers bow down to Jesus in verse 19 in absolute mockery, and they spit on him, and they whack him on the head with a cane. And eventually in verse 20, the soldiers have had their fun mocking Jesus, so they reclaim the purple robe. It's already served its purpose in their sick game. You see, the soldiers are a bit like a cat who's toyed with a terrified mouse and eventually kills it. Eventually, they lead the mocked and belittled and bloodied Jesus away to die. A Roman execution squad, probably four soldiers and a centurion, leads Jesus away. And friends, in today's passage, a key question to ask is this. Who was responsible for Jesus' death? The religious leaders, Judas, Pilate, the Romans, the crowds which had bayed for Jesus' blood? Or was God responsible? Well, friends, the answer to all these is yes. All those people were responsible. Blame for Jesus' death lies squarely with human beings. But friends, God's also responsible. He's not responsible in the sense of blame, as if he's guilty of doing wrong, but responsible in the sense of being ultimately and completely in control in Jesus' death, achieving his own good purposes through it. Jesus himself knew that he must and would be killed. We saw that in chapter 8:31 and 9:31 and chapter 10:33. Jesus knew that this was to ransom many people from their sins in chapter 10:45. And in Luke chapter 24, Jesus showed this very fact from the scriptures, that God had planned Jesus' death and had foretold it in the Old Testament. Friends, human beings were responsible for Jesus' death, and God was responsible, which is what verse 16 to 20 show us. In these verses, the soldiers are morally responsible. So you may have noticed how many times the word "they" was used. They actively mistreat and torture Jesus before taking him away to die. But God's involved as well. You see, here Jesus fulfills God's prophecy for a suffering servant from Isaiah 53. This sufferer, according to Isaiah 53:7, would be like a lamb led to the slaughter. And that's exactly what happens here in verse 20. Jesus, like a helpless lamb, is led out to die. Friends, in this passage about Jesus' death, human beings are wickedly responsible for evil actions, but God is sovereignly in control, achieving his good purposes. And we'll see more of that as we go along. Well, friends, in the Roman Empire, they practiced conscription, as many countries do, and as Australia has in the past. And in verse 21, we see an example of conscription. An individual passerby is conscripted by the soldiers, and this is Simon of Cyrene. You see, criminals condemned to crucifixion normally carried the heavy wooden crossbeam themselves to the execution. But here, by now, Jesus would be extremely weak, and so Simon is conscripted as cross carrier. And so eventually Jesus arrives outside the city at Golgotha, or Calvary. The scourged and beaten Jesus would be exhausted by now and in agony after his death walk. And at this point in verse 23, a small mercy is shown. He's offered some wine mixed with myrrh. And friends, this again fulfills prophecy. Psalm 69 verse 21 says, For my thirst they gave me sour wine to drink. And the wine's probably offered by the soldiers, but it may have been prepared by devout women who, according to Luke 23, followed Jesus' death walk. And their motivation in that case would spring from Proverbs 31, verse 6, give strong drink to the one who is perishing and wine to those in bitter distress. You see, friends, the wine mixed with myrrh was actually a primitive painkiller. They didn't have Panadeine back then, so this was a painkiller. And of course, normally when we're in pain, we eventually reach that point when we want relief. But here, friends, Jesus refuses the pain relief. He refuses the wine that's been laced. You see, he'd resolved back in Gethsemane, as Tom showed us a couple of weeks ago, to fully obey his Father in suffering the whole pain of the cross. So here he refuses the good stuff, which could dull the pain. Rather, fully conscious, with a clear and undrugged head, Jesus is crucified. And in verse 24, we don't get the details, but crucifixion involved having the arms attached to the crossbeam, which was then attached to the vertical pole, and the feet were attached to the pole, and the cross was hoisted, and you were left there to die of asphyxiation and blood loss and exhaustion. And callously, while this is going on in verse 24, the soldiers carry on a game. Leaving Jesus to die, they amuse themselves casting lots for his clothes. You see, people were normally crucified naked, although Jewish victims usually had a loincloth. So these soldiers think, Jesus is up on the cross, he's going to die, so there's no point wasting his clothes. And so they gamble for them. But friends, their callous actions, for which again they're completely responsible, actually fulfill more prophecy from Psalm 22, which Robert read. This psalm pictures a righteous sufferer who suffers by God's will at the hands of evildoers, but who's then vindicated by God. So we read Psalm 22, verse 18, "They divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots," exactly as these soldiers do. Friends, there's no doubt that Jesus is the righteous sufferer prophesied in Psalm 22. Well, we're told in verse 25 that Jesus was crucified at the third hour, that is at 9 a.m. And as was normal, the charge he'd been convicted of was attached to the cross, verse 26. Now, in Jesus' case, he'd technically been sentenced to death for claiming to be king of the Jews. And remember that the Roman king Caesar tolerated no rival kings. So this charge of treason is stuck to the cross. And friends, crucifixion was for the most despised criminals, like robbers. So it's not surprising that two robbers are crucified alongside Jesus in verse 27. But friends, that didn't happen just because the officer in charge decided it should. You see, this also fulfills Old Testament prophecy. Isaiah 53 prophesied about a servant who suffers by God's will to pay for the sin of others. And in Isaiah 53:12, we read of this servant that he poured out his soul to death and was numbered with the transgressors. So here in verse 27, we have Jesus being put to death with transgressors, the two robbers, just as Isaiah 53 prophesied. Well, friends, we've seen the soldiers doing their worst in mocking Jesus, but they're not the only ones to do that. So we read in verse 29 to 32 of others who also mock. So verse 29, bypassers mock Jesus. As they're walking past, going about their business, they can't help but sink the boot in. They wag their heads at a dying man and mock him, just like Psalm 22 prophesied. Psalm 22:7 says, "All who see me mock me. They make mouths at me. They wag their heads." And in their mocking, these passers-by falsely accuse Jesus. Verse 29, "You who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross." But as we saw last week, Jesus did not claim he'd destroy the temple. He only said that it would eventually be destroyed. So these uninformed bypassers mockingly imply that if Jesus is powerful enough to destroy the temple, surely he can save himself from the cross. And there's more mocking of this dying man in verse 31. And surprise, surprise, it's the religious elite, the chief priests and scribes, those corrupt rulers who've opposed Jesus all along and who've perjured themselves to see him condemned. They just can't leave it alone. They have to have one more last vicious go at him. These heroes say in verse 31 and 32, "He saved himself, he saved others, he cannot save himself. Let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down from the cross that we may see and believe." And in saying this, of course, they condemn themselves because Jesus had indeed saved others. Most startlingly, he'd raised Jairus' daughter from death in chapter 5. Yet they wouldn't believe back then. These religious leaders wrongly assume that because Jesus doesn't leave the cross, it means he cannot leave the cross. These self-serving leaders fail to see that there's a virtue much higher than self-preservation. It's not that Jesus can't save himself, it's that he determined in Gethsemane that he wouldn't save himself, rather that he'd give his life to save others. In fact, it's for that very reason that Jesus would never succumb to the mocking whim of the chief priests and scribes. These mocking leaders have already shown that despite their words here, they'd never believe, even if he did leave the cross. And friends, there's one other group who mock Jesus. It's the criminals, those who are dying with him, even in the face of death. We're told that they revile him. So friends, what stands out so far is how terrible and cruel and sinister is the mockery that Jesus, the dying righteous man, suffers. And how widespread the mockery is. He's mocked by the religious elite and the soldiers, by passers-by and by criminals. In a sense, you could even say he's mocked by church and state, by polite society, and by outlaws. Friends, here in a sense, humanity as a whole is represented as sneering at Jesus, the righteous sufferer of Psalm 22, the suffering servant of Isaiah 53. And friends, what happens when the righteous suffering servant is crucified? Well, between the 6th and the 9th hours, between midday and 3, the land's plunged into darkness. And no wonder, because humanity is murdering its maker. And the darkness, according to Amos 8, represents God's judgment. And friends, that's exactly what's going on here. Friends, in Jesus' crucifixion, God is indeed exercising judgment on Jesus. But it's not for anything that Jesus has done, not at all. But it's for what Jesus is representing, for what Jesus is bearing. Jesus is the suffering servant prophesied in Isaiah 53, punished for the sins of God's people. He's the servant upon whom God lays all our sin, Isaiah 53:6, who's wounded and crushed for that sin, Isaiah 53 verse 5, and who bears our sin, 53 verse 12. And so as Jesus hangs on the cross in agony, bearing in his body the sin of humanity, God crushes him. And friends, the noonday darkness of judgment also signifies that God has turned his back on Jesus. God, whose eyes are too pure to look on evil, turns because Jesus bears the evil of humanity's sins. In fact, according to 2 Corinthians 5, Jesus, who never ever sinned, actually became sin for us. And for this he suffered, becoming God forsaken. So he cries out, verse 34, using the words of Psalm 22, my God, why have you forsaken me? Friends, again here, Jesus clearly is the righteous sufferer prophesied in Psalm 22. But some bystanders mishear Jesus. He's called out, verse 34, in Aramaic to God, Eloi, Eloi, but they think he's calling Elijah, Eli, Eli. You see, Judaism back then predicted that the great prophet Elijah would return at a time of crisis to rescue the righteous. So these bystanders think, well, maybe Elijah's going to show up. Maybe he'll come back for Jesus. And one particular bystander gives Jesus a sponge with sour wine in verse 36. And again, this fulfills prophecy of Psalm 69, verse 21. But here, friends, the sour wine offered is unlike the wine and myrrh of verse 23. This sour wine that's offered is a stimulant. It's an upper, not a downer, and it was commonly used by Roman soldiers on duty. You see, this bystander wants to keep Jesus awake rather than him lapsing into unconsciousness. Because after all, imagine the spectacle if Elijah really does show up. But of course, Elijah doesn't show, and so in verse 37, Jesus, with a loud cry, dies. And Mark doesn't record what Jesus cried, but John does. So in John 19, verse 30, Jesus cries, "It is finished." And friends, this isn't, as I used to think before I believed the gospel, this isn't Jesus simply crying out in pain as death claims him. No, the commentators agree that it's a victory cry. You see, with his last breath, Jesus shouts that he's achieved his very purpose. As the righteous sufferer of Psalm 22, as the suffering servant of Isaiah 53, who bore the sins of many. As the one who, in his very own words in chapter 10, verse 45, the one who gave his life as a ransom for many. So, friends, this is a shocking and extraordinary moment. Jesus, wickedly killed by wicked humanity, fulfilling prophecy by God's good plan to save us from our sins. And, friends, in the very next verse, we can tell that Jesus was successful in doing this. So in verse 38, we read, "And the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom." The heavy-duty temple curtain separating the Holy of Holies from the outside was completely torn. The Holy of Holies, representing God's particular presence amongst his people, though he was separated from them. Because of people's sinfulness, access to God's presence behind the curtain was extremely limited. That's what the thick curtain represented. However, now, as Jesus dies, the curtain's irretrievably damaged. The barrier between sinful people and the holy God is gone. Jesus has at last made a way for sinful people to have access to this holy God and to have a relationship with God. Jesus has paid for our sin, so we're no longer separated from God. Now we, sinful people, can enjoy fellowship with the holy living God. Friends, what a glorious gospel truth that is. The true Son of God suffered according to God's plan, as the scriptures prophesied, at the hands of wicked humanity, so that all those who believe may have eternal fellowship with God. And friends, this of course is the great good news of the gospel. Because of Jesus' death on the cross, we who believe are brought into close, personal and permanent relationship with God. In fact, as forgiven sons and daughters of God. Well, friends, as you know, Jesus was a Jew, as were all his followers at that time. They were members of God's national people. And devout Jews within Israel had longed for salvation to come through God's Messiah, through the great King, God's great Son. So, friends, you'd think that the devout Jews would be the first to recognize God's true Son when he comes, that they'd be the first to confess Jesus as God's Son. But they're not. No, friends, in Mark's gospel, the first person to do that is the centurion, a pagan Gentile. In verse 39, when he saw that in this way Jesus breathed his last, the centurion said, "Truly, this man was the Son of God." And that's an amazing thing, because, friends, this centurion was naturally outside God's people, absolutely outside God's family. And yet this pagan recognizes in how Jesus died as the righteous sufferer and the suffering servant, he recognizes that Jesus is God's true Son. He confesses a basic but profound expression of faith. Faith even enough to save, faith even enough to become a child of God himself. So friends, in today's passage we've seen that Jesus is the true Son of God, who's willingly murdered by humanity to claim many sons and daughters for God from all humanity. So my simple question to you this morning is this: have you become a son or daughter of God? Have you turned to Jesus, who suffered the darkness of separation from God? Have you taken refuge in Jesus, so you needn't suffer eternal outer darkness away from God? Friend, do you, like the centurion, see Jesus as the true Son of God who died for your sin? And are you trusting in him? But friends, of course, the gospel message is not just for you, and it's not just for me. It's for all nations, all peoples. Again, the centurion was absolutely outside God's people, ethnically and culturally and religiously. He was an absolute outsider. But his confession of Jesus shows that outsiders can become insiders, and it can happen in a moment. Friends, today thousands and millions of people in Australia are outsiders. Many of them are from the nations, from people groups who've not had deep gospel impact, where Christian witness and Christian faith has been weak, where Jesus has been unknown. Friends, all people groups, fifth generation Aussies, and recent arrivals to our shores are everywhere in our nation, in our towns and our cities. Friends, these people need the gospel. They need to hear about Jesus, the true Son of God, so that they too might become reclaimed sons and daughters of God. Friend, what part will you play in their saving?